This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the second week of December, and this week Britain voted to get Brexit done. Boris Johnson's Conservative Party won a resounding victory in Thursday's election, and Jeremy Corbyn's Labour put up its worst result since 1935. Johnson closed the campaign with a Love Actually-themed ad, appealing to voters exhausted by years of Brexit debate, promising to get the thing over with by the end of next year so Parliament could move on. Everyone in the U.S. wants to take lessons from what happened in Britain, and obviously a big headline is that the left lost, hard. But there are other lessons, too. At the same time Boris Johnson co-opted the nationalist right on immigration in Europe, he grabbed the center on the economy. One of Johnson's arguments about why it was so good to get Brexit done was he would move next to strengthen the National Health Service, Britain's system for socialized medicine. And amazingly, polls showed more Britons trusted the conservative Johnson on the NHS than Labour's Jeremy Corbyn. So, have we seen the simultaneous death of Corbynism and Thatcherism? We'll discuss that later in the show with Andrew Sullivan, my colleague at New York Magazine, who has profiled both Johnson and Corbyn for us. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at... Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So turning to the United States, we've had a little bit of news over here. On Friday morning, the House Judiciary Committee approved two articles of impeachment against the president, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The full House is expected to vote on those next week. Liz, have Democrats picked the right offenses to impeach over?
I mean, I think they went for that narrow approach we've been talking about. And I think that their intent with what they chose, just two articles of impeachment, was to get the firmest, most unobjectionable and clear claims they could get. Now, as we saw from the debates in the judiciary, which were extremely personal and bitter and very protracted, the fact that those were, you know, fairly clear cut instances didn't really seem to help matters much. But you can imagine how much worse it would have been if they had gone for like a multi-pronged approach that was even more arguable. So I think ultimately they made a shrewd decision.
Rich, what did you make of these articles?
Well, it's narrow. I think they have the problem, I'll just repeat myself once again, is they have an impropriety here that should have been investigated, but the problem is coming up for the rationale justifying removal, and they've come on and off various things, most prominently bribery, which was a major focus for several weeks, apparently in part because it focus grouped well, but it was always a talking point masquerading as a legal argument, basically dropped in this article of impeachment, and I don't think either of them stand up very well or justifying removing a president from office. The obstruction charge is basically the White House saying what most White Houses say, well, we're not going to cooperate with you, and eventually it gets negotiated out, but it takes time to get negotiated out. And the underlying offense in the Ukraine charge, I think it's just being pumped up with various metaphors that aren't really justified by the facts.
I'm not sure the bribery isn't in here. I mean, they don't use the word bribery, but they describe the act that has been held out as an example of bribery, which is to say that he offered a state meeting at the White House in exchange for this demand that he had made. And similarly, the act that has been characterized as extortion is described in here, that he withheld $391 million in foreign aid funds in exchange for that. And I talked with Ken White about this on All the President's Lawyers on Wednesday. I think if you describe it as a bribery charge or an extortion charge, you end up in a debate about the federal criminal statute setting out what those offenses are and whether these acts meet those, which I think would have been a bit of a distraction because it kind of doesn't matter whether it meets the statutory crime of bribery or extortion. It's, you know, it's what we would colloquially describe as bribery or extortion. Those are both categories of abuses of power. I think that's why it's described as abuse of power here, because this is not a judicial proceeding. It's not the federal crime of bribery, but it is, you know, it is the action of bribery.
I just don't see how possibly it's bribery, even a colloquial understanding, is one of head of state pressuring another head of state to do something, which happens all the time. And if that's literally an act of bribery, then all presidents bribe foreign heads of state all the time.
No. It's offering something of value to the foreign head of state in exchange for an official action of that state that is of personal benefit to
but
him. The content is important.
Also, the personal benefit, I don't see that either. It's a political benefit, but presidents oftentimes have a view foreign policy through a political lens and their political priorities. So I just don't think bribery and extortion are the proper words to describe this. It's an improper use of presidential authority.
But hasn't the presidency, Trump's presidency in particular, been of personal benefit to him in a way that's a little bit worrying? So that, you know, re-election for Trump is partially political because it's about remaining at the head of state. But there have been, you know, numerous avenues through which he's managed to enrich himself further as president. We see reports all the time in The Washington Post, for example, of dignitaries and politicians staying at Trump properties for state affairs and so on and so forth. His kids have used it to sell books, and Ivanka, you know, early on seemed to be selling her fashion line vis-a-vis her father's presidency. So I think it's kind of hard in Trump's narrow case to distinguish the political benefit of him remaining in office from these personal benefits he's accrued.
But there's no personal benefit from Ukraine investigating Burisma again in that sense at all. And this is, again, I get to the practical effect of this. So at the end of the day, what they're asking for was Ukraine to investigate a shady energy company.
To announce an investigation.
Right. But to the end of ultimately getting investigated, they wanted them boxed in, as Sondland said.
Maybe.
And they wanted to release the money on the condition of the announcement, because once you've gotten a public official to say something, it makes them more likely they're going to do it. But let's say this had happened and Burisma was investigated again the way it was. There's some argument about this in 2014. What happens? What happens in American politics? What changes? Nothing. I mean, the problem with the Hunter Biden payments is the payments in and of themselves. That's why it's been so awkward for Joe Biden that Ukraine was going back and looking at, you know, maybe the licenses that Burisma got that got it started were corrupt or self-dealing. None of that's really going to intersect with American politics in any fundamental way.
Well, I don't think that's Trump's view on it. I think Trump's view on it was, I mean, the Burisma payments are, as you note, awkward and improper. What they don't appear to be is criminal. And what Trump wanted to be able to say was that there was a criminal investigation about the Bidens in Ukraine. And so it's sometimes hard to distinguish in these, you know, these global exploits, what the president has sent Bill Barr to find out in Italy or whatever. There are things that won't be found because they're not true, even though Trump thinks they are true. But there are also things that Trump just wants to be able to put out there that many people are saying that they are the case. And he wanted to be able to say, oh, you know, well, many people are saying that Biden is looking at, that Ukraine is looking into criminal acts by the Bidens, and Trump and people around him have been explicitly accusing the Bidens not of impropriety or creating the appearance of impropriety, but of crimes. So I think that was the political purpose of that.
It wasn't an investigation of Burisma was not an investigation of Joe Biden. It just wasn't.
Well, yes,
it wouldn't have been.
The back and forth was about Trump wanting the word Biden said in the announcement. I think, you know, they talked about Burisma as a code word, but Trump clearly wanted this discussed as a Biden criminal investigation.
Well,
he doesn't care about some gas company.
Believes that, in part because he tends to believe in conspiracy theories, that there was some dark misconduct there beyond just the mere fact that Hunter Biden was getting thrown tens of thousands of dollars at him a month for the mere fact that he was the vice president's son, especially at a time when the vice president was the point man of the United States government.
Well, I think this gets at an issue that comes up when you discuss possible criminal investigations with the president, which is that his loose attachment to reality makes it difficult to establish mens rea because you don't know what his mental state is and what his beliefs are. But again, I think that's a key issue for criminal trials. I'm not sure that Congress has any constitutional obligation to make that distinction in evaluating these sorts of questions. But I'd like to move on and talk about the Senate trial that we're heading toward. Rich, have you gotten any updates from Republican senators? How they're thinking about what kind of trial, if any, to hold once the president is impeached?
Still hasn't been fully decided. I would expect a trial of some sort to take place and for it to be expeditious. And I just think at the end of the day, they're going to conclude that no matter how much Trump wants Hunter Biden to be a witness or Adam Schiff to be a witness or the whistleblower to be a witness, once you get down the road to calling witnesses, it's going to be really hard not to call all the other witnesses that have more relevant information to what happened here, and there's no upside of the White House for that. And the basic argument that Republicans will make is just this matter doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. So I think that all points towards hearing from the managers of both sides, the prosecution and the defense, coming over from the House and then swiftly dismissing the matter and acquitting.
Yeah, Liz, I mean, one thing when we talk about how expansive this process should be, not all the fact-finding is supposed to be the House's job. The Senate trial could be an opportunity for further fact-finding and for further public presentations, but I'm not betting too hard on the idea that we're going to learn a lot during the process of the Senate trial.
No, I don't think that Democrats intend to use it that way. I think that their focus has been on getting this over with as quickly as possible. And I don't see them departing from that strategy anytime soon. I think they think there's enormous political value in making it appear simple, clear-cut, and closed case. I think that they don't want necessarily, even though it might be revelatory, a long fight in which a lot of details come out, but into which a lot of confusion is introduced.
Rich, I think a lot of Republicans they've been trying to send the message that Democrats are going to regret doing this. And the polling hasn't moved around very much. But I also think I'm not sure exactly how to think about what's a good poll for Republicans on impeachment. But I think they may have the wrong metric, where they sort of basically think any poll that says more people don't want the president removed than do is a good poll. There was a Marquette Law School poll in Wisconsin this week, and Wisconsin has continued to be very close in spite of national polls where the president's losing. That poll had impeachment underwater by 12 in the state of Wisconsin, but it still had Biden leading the president by one. And so I guess my question is, how underwater does impeachment have to be for Republicans to feel good about it? Because nobody who's for impeachment and removal is going to vote for Trump. But you can think of all sorts of voters who are against impeachment and removal who might vote against Trump, mm-hmm. whether, you know, they think this is bad but not serious enough to remove him, or, you know, they don't like Mike Pence or that sort of thing. And if you look back at 1998 was a good year for Democrats in a backlash to the impeachment. But, I mean, impeachment was polling at less than 30. So it wasn't as good a year for Democrats as you would have thought if you just looked at those impeachment polls. So how unpopular does impeachment have to be for Republicans to feel good?
Well, I think they can feel good about the national numbers now, which are a sign that in other key districts and states, it's underwater. And given the popularity of basic Republican positions now on a lot of things, which isn't high, having an issue where you're on the right side by 12 points is like a big deal. But I do continue to believe that in January, after Trump's acquitted, this will disappear pretty quickly in our national politics. It will endure, I think, with some of these relatively moderate Democrats in Trump districts who will get hit on this issue all the way to November.
Liz, are you nervous about that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you know, increasingly.
So one way that the Democrats have been trying to inoculate themselves against these attacks, the do-nothing Democrats are so distracted by impeachment, they're not doing anything, is they've actually been doing a fair bit in the last couple of weeks, and they've been doing it together with the president. This has been a weirdly intense December for legislative productivity. I want to talk about that in a moment with Rich Lowry on the right, Elizabeth Brunig on the left. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center. And we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at... So on Tuesday next week, the House of Representatives is expected to impeach the president, and on Wednesday, they are expected to approve his revised trade deal with Canada and Mexico. This was a long time coming. House Democrats had reservations about a number of aspects of Trump's USMCA trade deal, especially to do with labor rights in Mexico. But Trump and the Mexican government made concessions to get the AFL-CIO on board, and now Democrats are ready to approve the deal. Republicans and Democrats have also reached a deal on federal spending levels, setting federal government priorities through next September and resolving some disputes over wall funding and other matters. There's also a deal to create the Space Force Trump wants. In exchange, Democrats will get a paid parental leave benefit for federal workers. And there may even be a deal for a federal law on surprise medical bills. That's where you show up to a hospital that's in your network, and then somehow an anesthesiologist you never even met sends you a bill for $20,000 after you left. Details on fixing that are still being worked out, but there have been positive signs. To talk about this, I actually want to bring in Andrew Sullivan a little bit early. Andrew's my colleague at New York Magazine. In a little bit, we're going to talk about the British elections. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Josh. Wonderful to be here.
First of all, congratulations.
Thanks. I'm a little wrecked after last night, to be honest with you. It was a good night for Tories.
Yes. We'll get to that in a moment. Rich, one thing that I think is happening here with this burst of productivity in Congress is each side is accusing the other of being too distracted to get anything done, and that's increased their incentive to get something done.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. It's also just coalition management on the part of Nancy Pelosi. She, to simplify, is giving her base what it wants by impeaching the president and then giving her moderates, who are going to find the impeachment vote painful, even if they go along with it, what they want, which is bipartisan legislation. So it's not strictly contradictory what she's doing, but it is a bit odd to say that this president is a threat to our democracy and a threat to the integrity of the next election, but then give him a signature legislative victory in this new version of NAFTA that will help him at the margins win the next election you think should be disqualified from. And that's why we have this bizarre event where the House Judiciary Committee has voted out articles of impeachment during a week that has been a net positive for Trump.
Yeah, Liz, to Rich's point, that's an argument I'm hearing from a lot of liberals saying that this is a political mistake to give Trump this victory. Democrats should be taking more of a page from Mitch McConnell and sort of trying to deprive Trump of anything that he can brag about. Are those critics right? Is Pelosi making a mistake?
I mean, I think they have a point. I think it's difficult to dispute the fact that this is going to give as much of an edge to Trump as it does to them. So it sort of neutralizes any benefits they might accrue by being Democrats who are getting things done instead of the do-nothing Democrats. At the same time, I think it's worthwhile heading into 2020 for Democrats to say, look, we've tried to make the best of this presidency. We've kept the American people as our first priority. We haven't simply blocked every legislative goal of this administration precisely because some of them were decent. You can see that being the beginnings of a pitch to peeling off some independents.
Andrew, in a weird way, this reminds me of what happened during the Clinton impeachment, which is to say 1998 was an extremely bitter political year. Republicans tried to move an impeachment that was a lot more unpopular than the one we're seeing right now. And yet Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich and other congressional Republicans got significant legislative accomplishments done during that process, I think in response to some of the same political incentives.
Yeah, you can do both at the same time. My concern is that treating this president as anything but an emergency dampens and weakens the case against him because he is such an extreme outlier in terms of presidential conduct, in terms of his attacks on the Constitution, in terms of the cult that he has built. He is an incredibly dangerous demagogue who should be impeached and should have been impeached a long time ago. And the trouble with saying you still want to help the country when we have this figure behaving as he has in office is a very hard circle to square. And I think you just have to go ahead with impeachment for the Constitution's sake and for the country's sake and for the sake of liberal democracy. But you have to keep telling people that you also have a program for government and it's better than his and you want to make a positive case for it.
You know, Liz, I think it's implicit in a lot of things Democrats do that Trump is not an emergency for the country, or at least not a particular emergency compared to a normal Republican president, which is to say, if it was desperately necessary for the future of the republic that Donald Trump lose the next election, you would think Democrats would be trying to figure out what they can compromise on, what they can do to expand their coalition as much as possible to build a large majority to bury him. And I think you're not really seeing that. I think you're seeing more normal politics. I mean, obviously, they want to win the next election, and they're trying to figure out how to build that coalition. But they're also, they're very focused on getting what they can in terms of policy. They don't want to, they don't want to move away from core principles of the party in order to avert this emergency because they're basically treating it as normal politics.
Well, rhetorically, they treat it as an emergency. That's been sort of the key rhetoric of the resistance movement in the wake of 16. And I do think you see some Democrats who try to make the argument, for instance, that we should essentially forego a primary in order to do as much coalition building as we possibly can, precisely because this is such an emergency and any noise of dissent in the Democratic coalition is essentially a vote for Trump, and that's deadly. And I do think there are various ways in which Trump has been an especially dangerous Republican president, especially to do with conditions at the border, which just seem to get worse and worse. But there are also a lot of ways in which Donald Trump has been a fairly ordinary Republican president. And I think that Democrats are pretty wise not to take the tack, at least publicly, in their political dealings, that this is an absolute You know, five alarm emergency. A lot of people voted for Donald Trump. They want to be able to win those voters. And I think they sense that they're not going to be able to do that by suggesting that the guy they voted into office is an existential threat to the United States.
Well, can I ask you which previous Republican has violated, has committed obstruction of justice, who has perjured himself under oath, who has ripped up the constitutional order, who has empowered a cult to overrule the entire government of the United States, who has compromised the United States national security, who is at this moment conspiring with foreign governments to affect the next election? I mean, tell me a previous Republican who's done that. I mean, Nixon doesn't come close.
Isn't the Iran-Contra scandal in a lot of ways structurally similar to the abuses that Trump has committed?
Absolutely. And did Nixon not commit numerous offenses of a similar kind in terms of committing crimes to get into office?
Not as frequently and as consistently as this guy.
So it's a matter of degree? I mean, I don't think Trump is good. I don't think he's ripped up the constitutional order. I don't think that his compromising of national security has been especially worse than, say, Bush's. There was a report in the Washington Post just last week that kind of landed with a dull thud, but that should have been a really big deal, that demonstrates that the American government, beginning with Bush, has been lying to the American people about our activities in Afghanistan for years, for the entire time we've been there. And that has significantly compromised national security by enabling global terrorism. So, I mean, yeah, I think he's bad, and I think we should get him out of office. I'm not sure that he is the extreme threat and extreme anomaly that he's often depicted as, because I think that other Republican presidents have been worse than we have depicted them as.
I do want to talk a little bit about some of the specifics of what has happened this week. Rich, I saw some grumbling from Republicans about this deal that Trump cut with Pelosi on the trade deal. Basically, Senate Republicans feeling like they were cut out of the process as concessions were made to labor. This Space Force for parental leave deal for federal workers, this is a key policy objective for Democrats. I'm not sure that the Space Force is really a key policy objective for Republicans in the way that it is for the president. So is there, did the president get rolled here in certain ways, or did Senate Republicans get rolled in terms of the way the president makes compromises that conservatives weren't really bought into them in certain ways?
I think it's the latter. I think it's a victory for the president. It's not a victory for Senate Republicans. And the trade deal, the best you can say for it is it will prevent Trump, if he wins a second term, from tearing up NAFTA. And there'll be something that will be his and he has ownership of. But it's not a better trade deal. It modernizes NAFTA to some extent in ways it needed to be modernized, using, ironically enough, language from the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump, for no good reason, jettisoned right at the outset of his administration. And then otherwise, it's there are more tariffs, there's more labor provisions, and it's very bad for the auto industry. So net-net, this is a worse version of NAFTA, but would be better than nothing.
Seems like, though, Andrew, there's a silver lining with Trump in here for you, right? That, this protectionist president came in, ends up effectively ratifying a key piece of the global trade agreement system.
Yes, in many ways, although that's not what he promised to do, and it's not what he will deliver. And the question is whether, recognizing that in policy terms, Trump hasn't been able really to move anything towards a new politics that actually appeals to his rising coalition, is in the long run not good for him. I mean, he's been unable to do really almost anything on immigration, get anything through the Congress. He's done nothing on trade. We'll see what happens with China, but it doesn't feel as if it's going to be any structural change. So he's basically breaking every promise that he made, and that's got to have a long-term impact.
As for the parental leave for Space Force deal, Liz, I imagine you have to be pretty happy with this. My recollection is that in addition to, I'm sure you're in favor of parental leave, that you also have a bit of a soft spot for the Space Force.
Huge soft spot for the Space Force. I'm extremely pumped about the Space Force. I mean, should we be heading into space with a militant foot forward? Probably not. I would prefer a more peaceable approach to space. But I think that, putting a greater emphasis on getting into space and expanding our horizons in that direction is really cool.
There was one more area of productivity this week, which is that China and the U.S. seem to have made another step toward this so-called Phase One trade deal. The main important thing from the twin announcements from the U.S. and China is something that won't happen. China and the U.S. won't impose new increased tariffs that were supposed to go into effect on Sunday. We'll also be reducing our existing tariffs on Chinese goods by a little bit. Goods mostly bought by U.S. companies will still be tariffed at 25%, but the 15% tariff on about $100 billion in Chinese consumer goods will be cut to 7.5%. China is supposed to agree to more market access for U.S. financial services firms and to better protect U.S. intellectual property. China also says it's going to buy more U.S. agricultural goods, but they're trying to maintain some wiggle room about exactly how much. Rich, is this a victory on China trade?
No, I think it's better than spiraling ever downward into more of a trade war, but it's very likely the provisions on intellectual property and greater market access, that there's probably less there than meets the eye. And probably also in what President Trump will really wave around, obviously, is whatever the number commitment is to buy more soybeans and other American agricultural products. In the past iterations of this near deal, you find out that basically they're coming up with a big number that represents like what they would buy anyway, really. So it's, again, like the new version of NAFTA, it's better than the alternative, but it's not transformative by any means.
Liz, the tariffs were never going to push the U.S. into recession, but they were a little bit of a drag on the economy. And this move, probably means, adding a tenth of a point to GDP or something like that, a little bit of an economic boost. It's another thing at the margin to think that President Trump is going to go into re-election with economic tailwinds.
Yeah, and I think there's no way around that. I mean, as long as circumstances don't radically change in the few months before we're really in the heat of 2020, I think Trump will have on his side the kind of economy that would make any other Republican a shoo-in. It's only impeachment, essentially, and then the rest of the associated scandals involving Trump that are going to work against him. So Democrats will have to be very careful to tailor their message to deal with that fact. We talked about this last time, but it's difficult to have a Democratic message that focuses on how many people are struggling when it seems like the economy is doing pretty well. So I think Democrats will have to be careful to account for that and have to be careful to promise to preserve, various economic successes we've had under Trump. And a lot of those aren't his responsibility. They're things that we're developing under Obama. But Democrats need to acknowledge that as they go into 2020.
Still with me are Liz Brunig on the left and Rich Lowry on the right, and now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters, or maybe 280, to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig.
From comedy user PemPem, if we go back to centrism like we had in 2016, we'll win again, just like Hillary Clinton did. Great take on labor's loss.
Rich Lowry.
My tweet, unfortunately, is a partially visual tweet. It has to do with the Republican counsel for the Intelligence Committee who showed up at the Judiciary Committee hearings this week with a Fresh Market bag that he was holding all his belongings and briefing materials in. And J.D. Durkin tweeted, question, hey, you bringing your briefcase today for your nationally televised impeachment hearing, right? Answer, no, I'll be fine with this.
My tweet of the week came from very eager British socialist columnist Owen Jones, who said yesterday afternoon, there are lots of rumors flying around about Boris Johnson on the verge of losing his seat. If you can get the vote out there, do it now. It could make all the difference. To say the least, that did not happen. Boris Johnson was easily reelected in his seat of Uxbridge and South Ryslip, which is far from the silliest UK parliamentary constituency name, though it's up there. And his party won a resounding national victory. When we come back, we'll talk about why with Andrew Sullivan. I'll be back with Liz Brunig, Rich Lowry, and Andrew for more of Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at... And Andrew Sullivan of New York Magazine is also with us. Somehow, Boris Johnson not only became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, it looks like he may be the most politically successful Conservative Prime Minister since Margaret Thatcher. How the bloody hell did that happen? I'm really glad that we have Andrew Sullivan here to talk about this with us. Andrew wrote a prescient profile of the conservative leader titled The Blundering Brilliance of Boris Johnson for the last issue of New York Magazine. He also previously profiled Jeremy Corbyn. Andrew, how did we get here?
We got here because Boris realized that there was an extraordinary opportunity here. And because the British people voted narrowly, but they did vote to leave the European Union, and the political elites spent the last 3 years attempting to stop it in Parliament. And Boris decided at one point that he was going to call their bluff and have an election entirely on getting Brexit done, while also pivoting left on economics to create what is, I think, a possible permanent governing majority for the Conservatives in the United Kingdom, which is a very big deal. It's a formula of patriotism, nationalism, controlling our borders, and redistribution to the poor and working classes, a concentration on public spending and public services, a much more expansive Tory message that is far different than Thatcher's in as much as it's directly appealing to the very regions that Thatcher destroyed, the Northeast, the Midlands, all of which just expressing the very basic view that they'd like to run their own country, thank you. And they don't want to be run by foreign entities in Brussels. And they'd like to have control of their borders. And when they were told that this made them racists and bigots, they decided to tell the elites what they thought of them. And that's why it's been this crushing victory.
Rich, I mean, since you've been an advocate of increasing nationalism on the right, you obviously have your book about it. One thing that Andrew makes clear in his Boris Johnson piece is the importance of this economic element to that. His piece says, Tory social democracy rooted in national pride and delivered with a spoonful of humor and entertainment, unquote, is the Johnson formula. Now, it may be a bit of a stretch to describe him as a social democrat, but I think Andrew is right that the spending promises, talking about spending more on the NHS, this move away from Thatcherism was an indispensable part of Boris Johnson's formula to invade Labour's working class heartlands and take away what votes from people who, you know, despised Margaret Thatcher. What are the lessons there for the U.S.? I mean, if the Republican Party is going to complete this realignment and become a party that really appeals to the working class, aren't they going to have to move away from economic agendas that, you know, the president has made rhetorical noises in this direction, but his signature economic achievement is a big tax cut that focuses on the wealthy and corporations?
Yeah, so there's no doubt the Tories are going to be a bigger spending party going forward. I don't think they're going to throw all caution to the winds and totally blow it out. They'll continue to be market oriented, but it is a new iteration of the party. And just quickly on Johnson, I mean, you have to give him enormous credit that he had a theory of the case. He followed through with it after humiliating a defeat in Parliament, stuck it out, and it worked. And this is just a great example of how political leadership matters. Theresa May never would have been able to carry it out. And there is, you know, as Andrew and others have pointed out, there's a certain X factor to Boris. A colleague of mine from Britain joked that we both knew he was a man of destiny several years ago when he was mayor of London, and he was on a zip line. He had a ridiculous helmet. He was like wearing shorts. He like bumped into some people. It was just like an absurd spectacle, but it was enjoyable and winsome. And he just has that ability and that X factor at a certain level, which you can't substitute from. But there's no doubt that, you know, in the United States, this kind of shift of the coalition is happening as well, and the party has to change. And Boris's victory shows the potential power of a more populist and nationalist Republican Party in this country. It just what exactly the policy mix is and how you integrate it with the general market orientation without throwing out the baby with the bathwater is still a question that 3.5 years or 3 years in the Trump administration hasn't been answered.
Liz, a lot of people on the global left were very excited about Jeremy Corbyn. What went wrong with him?
Well, several things. I mean, the Labour Party, and Corbyn included, had difficulty committing to a position on Brexit. At first, you know, they said, well, let's respect the referendum. You know, that's what people voted for. And then there were increasing difficulties maintaining that position. And you ended up getting this strange position that there needed to be another referendum on Brexit, which is basically what last night was. And that didn't turn out to be helpful for them at all. Corbyn has also endured quite a lot of attacks that I think have a bit of smear in them concerning whether or not he himself is an anti-Semite or whether the Labour Party is anti-Semitic. Certainly with any political coalition, you're going to find some people who have reprehensible opinions. That's true of the left as well as the right, just in different concentrations. But I feel like those attacks hurt him, and I feel like he was unwilling to rebut them in the strongest terms he could out of respect and out of a wish to be conciliatory. So I think lots of things conspired to bring him down.
Andrew, what do you make of that?
I'm a little shocked, to be honest. I think the evidence of widespread, vicious, horrifying anti-Semitism within the Labour Party, which has been demonstrated, for example, in the Jewish Labour Movement's presentation to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission in Britain, which is the only party that's been subjected to this test, other than the British National Party, the far right. No, this is part of the global left's view that Israel is obviously a white supremacist state, and that our job is now to fight white supremacy. Corbyn also ran on an extraordinary increase in public spending and borrowing, and massive investment by the government and by the state in controlling the means of production. We were back to the 1970s, or even really the 1940s. And he was also someone, and is someone, who wants to break up NATO, who hates the United States. He would have rendered the most radical reorientation of Britain's foreign policy for over a century. And the left, the intellectual left, could not bring themselves to say that this is a disaster and this is a bad set of ideas, that they need to get away from this kind of extremism, and they need to have a leader who does not attract these poisonous people. I mean, this is not just a few. It is not just a few. And he tolerated it because he has his own history of extraordinary, at the least, extraordinary indifference to the difficulties that Jewish people have had in history and in contemporary life.
I think in any case, the concerns about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party were very real, and the feeling that Jeremy Corbyn had not dealt with them effectively was a fact on the ground among the voting public. But it was part of a broader thing where Corbyn's leadership came out of a really bitter power struggle in the Labour Party between leftist forces behind him and more centrist forces that were more aligned with the sort of prime minister that Tony Blair had been. And the case from the Corbynistas had been that, you know, people want a choice, not an echo, and you need a more radical platform, and that will connect better with voters and win. And that clearly did not pan out. And so I guess my question is there a lesson here for the U.S. left? If the case is, you know, go left, do what this, you know, very loud and active part of the party wants to do, and you'll win. I mean, this certainly seems like a data point against that, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways that the right can win a victory over the left. One of them is the left being too radical, which will be argued to have been the case with Labour. And one of them is apparently the left not being radical enough, which is what happened in 2016, arguably, right? So the left loses in the United States when it's very centrist, and it sometimes loses when it's radical. We should definitely give the radical loss a try, because I don't really think we've ever really given that a shot. But we've certainly seen the left lose when it was extraordinarily cautious and centrist. So I wouldn't overdraw lessons from Labour's loss.
Rich, do you draw lessons from this outcome?
Well, I think the lessons are somewhat limited in that you have the overlay of Brexit, which we don't have in this country. And as Andrew's been pointing out, you have the uniquely toxic nature of Jeremy Corbyn. But this is clearly a sign that the Democratic Party goes in a radical direction at its own risk. And I think one interesting hypothetical here is how would a Labour Party that had been pro-Brexit would have fared? How a Labour Party that would have attempted to appeal to some of these nationalistic and patriotic sentiments have fared? And this just goes back to another boring point I constantly go back to. I think there is room for the Democrats going in a more populist direction on economics, but they cannot go even further left on cultural issues or have to show a little flexibility and compromise there. And in this country, they show no sign of doing that. Well, I shouldn't say that. You know, Biden has resiliency, and he's not woke the way the rest of the party is. But it's clearly the drift of the party, and one that poses an enormous risk, I think, to their electoral chances.
Andrew, can you talk a little bit about what's next in Britain for Brexit? So, the Prime Minister says he's going to get Brexit done. What's that going to look like over the next few years? What can we expect out of this government?
Well, it will be very easy to predict the withdrawal agreement will pass and the United Kingdom will be out of the EU next year. Then there will be, of course, endless trade negotiations about the precise alignment of the UK in its trade policy with the EU and with the US. Everything has to be renegotiated. That will take a long time. I suspect the following, that Boris will eventually reach an agreement with the EU that looks very much like Theresa May's, and no one will care. I mean, I think that's the truth, people will forget Brexit. They want to move on desperately from the subject. They are not going to be poring over the details of trade agreements, for God's sake, with the most mind-numbing things imaginable. There will be some people on the hard right that will be absolutely apoplectic, but Boris has got a big enough majority to tell them to go jump in a lake. And Boris is nothing if not opportunistic and ruthless. So I imagine Boris is going to shift the subject away from Brexit, focus on public spending and public services, focus on the environment, and focus on cutting taxes for the working classes and working poor. And I think that will change the dynamic of British politics. I think those that think that it's now going to be a massive British fight over the nature of what Brexit is, I think are delusional. I don't think that's going to be the case.
Liz, one upshot of being out of the EU is that it creates more space for political change in Britain. They're not governed by a wide variety of EU rules and regulations that hemmed in public policy. And that opens up space for political change in all sorts of directions. And I assume this was part of the reason for the ambivalence about the EU and about Brexit on the left, that, you know, in certain ways, you get left opportunities out of not being in the EU anymore.
Yeah, of course, especially regarding labor and the movement of workers and capital. You know, like you said, it could go either way. If you're having a right-wing swing, it could go further to the right and away from certain stopgaps that had to do with being in the EU. Could go the other way if you can conjure up a sort of left grassroots movements. I think, you know, for the criticisms of Corbyn that were legitimate, and there were criticisms of Corbyn that were legitimate, he did bring a grassroots presence back to Labour. I think the possibility is there. I was always sort of agreeable to the idea of respecting the referendum on Brexit. You know, people at the end of the day in liberal democracies, they have their right to self-determination. I do think there are possibilities open. The fact that there's sort of a global rightward swing isn't very promising, but, you know, I'll keep my hopes up.
People on the left have sometimes criticized the EU as a neoliberal institution. And I think in a lot of ways that is correct, that there are rules about international dealing that were enshrined mm-hmm. in the EU that align to conservative principles that will no longer control Britain. And I don't know, Rich, what do you make of that? Because I know you have had sort of a gut level inclination toward Brexit. But I mean, isn't the EU giving up certain international institutions that conservatives should actually favor?
Well, I just think as a bargain basement proposition, Britain should be governed by Britain and in Westminster, not in Brussels. And even if the EU rules in some respects are policies that I would support, certainly over the alternative.
I wonder, though, And Andrew, I guess, can speak to this better than I can. How big a change is this really going to mean in UK immigration policy? I mean, UK is, you know, is a very cosmopolitan country. They're not going to shut off immigration on account of this. And more broadly, I would have been a soft Remain voter in 2016 if I lived in the UK. I think, as I noted, there's a lot that I like about the EU, even though I understand certain objections. And I think there are significant and real economic costs to leaving. But I think people oversold a little bit, or actually oversold a lot, what the downsides of Brexit were. Britain is a big enough and wealthy enough country to be totally independent if it wants to be. And I think there was a lot to Boris Johnson's argument that, you know, let's get this over with because otherwise we're going to fight about this forever. But part of why I think that is that I don't think Britain's relationship to Europe is going to change as much as it's been made out to. It's still going to be right there. These are still going to be major trading partners. And I assume that Britain is going to continue to have an enormous exchange, not just of goods, but of people with other countries. And so that's, you know, part of why I don't, you know, worry too much about Brexit.
I don't think it's going to be revolutionary, no. I mean, not in terms of the demographics of the United Kingdom. And of course, it doesn't have anything to do with immigration from outside the EU, which is very significant. But I would say the following two things: that Boris has proposed and is proposing to reform the entire immigration system so that it is like the Australian one, which is the points system where you can get into a Western country because you have particular skills or education, period. And that's a very important moment in the West. If Britain follows Australia, and it's certainly what the Republicans are proposing here, then that shifts immigration dramatically as an issue. The other thing I would say that's important, I think the EU is the biggest force for far-right white nationalism in the world. I think its increasing ambitions, and again, people talk about the EU as if it's been the same thing since the 70s. It is very different now than it was when Britain joined. It really does want to control the nation states in ways that it never did before. It's aggressively pushing towards a united political project. And this attempt to do this and to violate the integrity and the importance of people's national identities has created the far right. And what Boris did in this election was co-opt it and destroy it. The Brexit Party is at 2%. You compare that with the AfD in Germany or the Le Pen forces in France or Salvini in Italy. The EU is a very destabilizing force in the world. And I think Britain will be the first country, but not the last, to come out. The EU is going to attempt to bloody Britain on the way out because it knows that if Britain survives and thrives, the EU is under extreme pressure.
I mean, Britain's a very special case because it doesn't participate in the single currency, which, as messy as Brexit will be, it's a lot less messy than trying to get out when all of your government debt is issued in euros. But I want to close by asking, Liz, do you buy that broad case there that Brexit in the long run is actually going to take the sting a little bit out of nationalism, whereas in Europe, where you have these countries that really can't divorce, you're likely to see, you know, longer and stronger right-wing movements?
No. No, I mean, I don't think that white nationalism is a response to the EU. White nationalism, you know, insofar as it is reactionary, is a response to the ongoing effects of colonialism. Right, the door swings both ways. So when you're an empire building nation, as the UK was, you're going to draw in people from the provinces that you have colonized, and then that is going to induce panic in the host state, which has been going on in the United Kingdom since, you know, at least the high 19th century and continues now. You're seeing the ramifications of political decisions that were made a long time ago, but that continue to have aftershocks. I think that helped create white nationalism as we know it. Certainly possible that later political activities can aggravate those pre-existing impulses. And I'm sure that has been the case with the EU. But it was an impulse that was already there. It was already pretty vigorous. And I don't think it will go away just because they have gotten Brexit. I don't think that by bringing in white nationalists who supported Brexit for specifically white nationalist reasons and giving them what they want, Boris Johnson will have calmed them down at all, right? Victories aren't really known to innervate in that way politically. I think that they will remain an active force in the United Kingdom.
Let's leave it there. I want to thank Andrew Sullivan, my colleague at New York Magazine, for joining us. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh. It's been a pleasure.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
There are a few journalists on the right, Kim Strassel of the Wall Street Journal, Molly Hemingway of the Federalist, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner, who have warned for years that the Steele dossier distorted the Russia investigation and the FBI abused its power. Their coverage ran against the conventional wisdom and was often scorned. But now that we have the IG report of the Justice Department, we know that they were largely right. Well done.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
As a millennial, I got into adulting the hard way. I had a kid when I was 25. There's no way to avoid adulting at that point. But as I see other millennials take classes, learning how to cook or rent an apartment or apply for or leave jobs, and people mocking them for it, I get a little bit indignant. Look, they're trying to learn how to adult. Maybe they didn't pick up the skills they should have when they should have, but the fact that they're trying to is a good sign and a healthy thing.
For my rant, stop saying the polls aren't predictive anymore when what you mean is you didn't read the polls. Despite what you may have seen on Twitter, this election in Britain was not supposed to be close. The final Guardian poll average had the Tories up 10 points and they won by 11.5, which is pretty close. Similarly, the final Brexit referendum polls in 2016 had Leave and Remain tied. The final 2016 presidential polls had Hillary up 3 and she won the national popular vote by 2. If you were blindsided by any of the outcomes in those elections, that was your fault. It wasn't the pollster's fault. And similarly, you might want to look closer at the polling for the 2020 Democratic primary, which has Joe Biden always and forever in the lead. That might be a clue about who's going to win. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Andrew Sullivan. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. P.J. Shahamat is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.